Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. This is a special edition in collaboration with the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. Today, my conversation is with Kate Mann, an assistant professor of philosophy at Cornell University. As a feminist and moral philosopher, Mann examines an idea that has been inadequately addressed in her book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, published by Oxford University Press. She argues that misogyny is on the wane as a working concept, and situates her analysis in recent news stories and events. She offers a definition that is not psychological, but rather as a system of social control. Mann brings a fresh analysis to our understanding of misogyny and the related term sexism. Misogyny is selective because it targets those who fail to uphold the patriarchal standards of a woman's place in a masculine world and works as the policing and enforcement branch of the ideology of sexism. Women caught in asymmetrical moral support roles are expected to offer respect, deference, admiration, and gratitude to favorably situated men and provide, especially elite men, with comfort, care, and sexual and emotional labor in many different situations. Misogyny shows up in conversation, office politics, and the dispensation of favors flowing from a man's relative status, wealth, or celebrity. Rewards come to those who comply. In this scenario, women act as human givers rather than full and equal human beings. Mann's book is one for the moment. Here is my conversation with Kate Mann.
Now let me introduce you to the author, Kate Mann. Hello, Kate.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. So pleased to have you on this podcast as your book speaks very loud and clear to the present moment in gender relations. But before we get into the book, tell us about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Down Girl.
Oh, sure. So I am an assistant professor of philosophy at the Sage School of Philosophy at Cornell University. And I am originally Australian. I did my undergraduate degree at Melbourne and then went to MIT for graduate school, where I studied with Sally Haslinger, who I'm a big fan of, and who some of your listeners may be familiar with her work. And then I was at Harvard for a couple of years at the Society of Fellows as a junior fellow. And I've been at Cornell now since 2013. So I came to write the book actually after my first year of teaching here at Cornell. And the event that was sort of the immediate impetus for writing it was the Isla Vista killing by a man named Elliot Rodger on May 23rd, 2014. So I'd just wrapped up my first year of teaching and this young man was targeting and intending to kill an entire sorority house full of young women, female students at the University of California, Santa Barbara. So the fact that I was teaching and trying to think through some of the ways in which I could potentially shortchange my female students because of things like implicit bias, and also just thinking about their vulnerability to sexual assault on campus. For all of those reasons, those events were very, they were very salient to me and horrifying, as was the subsequent media denialism about the idea that this could be misogyny. So that's sort of the history of the book.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Did this also come out of your own personal experience, not just with your students, but your own private personal experience? Because I know you're relatively young, and you're just starting off on a career in philosophy. Have you experienced some of this in your own environments?
So I think the most probably formative thing for me in this respect was I went to an all-boys school in my final 2 years of high school, the first year that it integrated and went co-ed. So it was, hundreds of boys, maybe I think probably 500 or something, and three girls.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a pretty amazing odds there.
Yeah, it was... I think that, you know, it was sort of an interesting mixture of experiences, which I think it definitely guided me to philosophy, actually, because so much of what happened was sort of horrifying and, you know, left me pretty shattered, really, and frozen and in all of the sort of expectable ways. But I think after that, I had some sort of desire to enter male-dominated spaces and not feel like I was just going to die, which was sort of the phenomenology socially of being at that school, at least, you know, at least for certain periods of time for those 2 years. So, yeah, I think that... There's been something actually relatively healing about being in philosophy, which is very white male dominated and has a lot of problems and a lot of misogyny, which I don't want to underestimate by any means, but I've survived. So that's, you know, that feels like it's, something of a contrast to feeling just much less support and more threatened when I was younger.
Now you are a moral philosopher, is how you describe yourself. So why is this a moral issue, and why is philosophy involved in this? We tend to think of philosophy very differently from the way you're presenting it in this book. So can you tell me a little bit about moral philosophy and why this is moral philosophy?
Yeah. I really appreciate that question because I think I come at my discipline a bit differently than a lot of its practitioners. So one question in moral philosophy that's very important is what we ought to do about this or about that, what we ought to do about poverty, say, or whether we ought to eat meat. And I think those are often the most salient and familiar sorts of examples of questions asked by ethicists, at least in my milieu. But I think there is an equally important set of questions which come at it from another angle and ask, what is it not the case that we ought to do, that we may have been raised to think that we ought to do indeed? And what are some of the implicit shoulds, which often come in the form of social norms, of a kind of implicitly moralized nature that may be making us unfree? And, in particular, in this context, may be making either women in general or particular groups of women our lives much less good than they otherwise would be. Sometimes, with benefits to dominant men and sometimes not. So that's the kind of, that's the perspective as a moral philosopher that I think I'm employing here primarily in the book, looking at these ties that falsely bind or illicitly bind, this false sense of moral obligation, say to be loyal to a dominant man who has a history of serial sexual predation, say.
So there's in moral norms, there's a lot of naturalizing where we say this is the way it is, not just what ought to be, but also the way it is. And there's a lot of attempt to we can create a lot of false guilt.
Yes. And in a way that often comes via the principle ought implies can, and it's contrapositive where if you just negate the consequent of that conditional and say, well, it can't be otherwise, then you can't say, flipping this whole thing on its head, it's not the case that it ought to be otherwise. So if things right. are just naturally a certain way, then you can't really protest them. And that just means like certain kinds of sexist myths and rumors that men and women just are mutually exclusive and exhaustive categories of persons, which is false, of course, and that they have different proclivities, interests, appetites, and talents, which is again false, that will rule out certain kinds of demands for things to be vastly different socially, because it's just, it's a defunct demand if it's not the case, that it can be otherwise, then we don't get to say it ought to be.
And we also have some questionable social scientific work that's done that sort of tries to reassert differences that are questionable. This is the way men act on a date, and this is the way women should or do act on a date, that reinforces those norms. So it's sort of like almost like the race science of the 19th century. But so let me ask you a question. Let's go on to the topic of your book, which is misogyny. So what is it? Because I think we all kind of know what it is, but I think we sometimes lose the meaning of words. And especially since I did a Google search and in 1960s, it began to really show up and really increased the word misogyny increased in use up to the 1990s, and then it began a decline. And so, it's a word that we haven't heard very much now in the last, few months we have, but for years it was really kind of out of favor. So what is it, and why has it gone out? Why was it a waning working concept that we could actually use?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I think since about 2012, it's really, you can see if you look at the Google Ngram trend line, it spiked and is now kind of at an all-time high in terms of usage. So I think it's a word that has emerged in popular discourse as a common and sort of useful concept pretty recently. It's kind of got an interesting history as a word. So it was coined by, it was around 1615, I think. So at any rate, early 17th century feminists who were pushing back against Joseph Swetnam, who was this English pamphleteer who produced this screed against idle, lewd, inconstant, and froward, i.e. angry women. And these anonymous English feminists decided to sort of appropriate the ancient Greek roots to get a kind of a term with some gravitas to label this guy with. So there are just a few fragments of related words in texts in ancient Greek, but A, they seem to be slightly different usages, and B, I think there's only two occurrences that that are currently recognized. So really it's an English word. And yeah, I think that there have been certain points in our history where its connotations and its potential to label sheer hostility toward women has made it kind of unpopular. And I think, you know, my hunch is hostility needs to rise to a certain level, together with that feminist consciousness that first coined the term. Both need to rise simultaneously to a certain level in order for it to be, you know, in common parlance. So in a way, it's a word that we expect to see, I think, popping up when there's backlash to feminist progress.
Yeah, because it seems like, you know, around 2000, when it wasn't being used very much, that there was an assumption that women were making great strides in all professions. So we don't really need this word because women are really getting a lot of equality. But like you said, once there's an incident or something happens that kind of reminds everybody that things are not as equal as you think, this word comes out again. Now, one thing that you do is you are trying to get away from the idea of misogyny as just an individual psychological problem. And you're trying to give it a systemic sort of resonance. So talk about...
Yeah, my definition. Just to return for one sec, that's really interesting. I didn't know it was sort of at its nadir in 2000. That was the year after I graduated high school. And it was a word that was completely unavailable, as in I don't think it had even occurred to me that what I was facing might be misogyny back then. But my definition of it is meant to get at, it's meant to define it as primarily a property of social systems or environments as a whole, and in terms of what girls and women in that environment face, which, you know, will have a hostile flavor and serve to police and enforce patriarchal norms and expectations. So often that will have the form of punishing and expressing resentment and other sorts of hostile attitudes towards women who in some way transgress against the patriarchal order, whether that's by just being in a male-dominated space or whether that's by playing a role that's traditionally reserved for men or refusing to play a role that he typically feels entitled to a woman or girl in that kind of service position.
So how is this different from sexism? Because you still hear the word sexism or sexist. How is it different?
Yeah, so I think of misogyny as kind of the police force of a patriarchal order, law enforcement branch. And sexism, relating back to what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, sexism serves to naturalize and rationalize and justify a patriarchal order. So sexism is, if you will, a theory of why gender roles and norms just make good sense. And often that takes the form of, this is just the way men and women are, either intrinsically for each and every man and woman, or even on average, such that it doesn't really make sense to worry if, say, women are underrepresented in philosophy because men just naturally like it more, which is, I think, very likely either false or represents a contentious claim we couldn't possibly know yet because we have no control group for non-patriarchal society, you know, depending on exactly how it's formulated. And often these claims are just implausible given, in some cases, say in math, where women have been making huge strides in proportion to opportunity. Anyway, so...
Okay, so how is your definition or your understanding of misogyny differ from the work that's been done by feminist theorists and philosophers? Because it seems like they're not using that term that much. Why?
Well, misogyny had very little explicit theorizing from feminist philosophers in my tradition in philosophy, which is analytic. You know, I didn't find much work across the board about it. And I think that that's because it did fall out of favor. And a lot of the work that I've seen myself as just joining the dots between different, you know, concepts and notions and phenomena that have been really well theorized by feminist philosophers, like sexual objectification and oppression, and sexism has quite a bit of theorizing. And, you know, there's been a lot of very good work, a ton of it really, on in feminist philosophy of language that brings out ways in which language can be both objectifying and subordinating and degrading in various ways that both reflect and constitute social norms that of a gendered kind. Anyway, so all told, this is not to say that by any means there isn't tons of relevant related work in the vicinity that I'm drawing on, but I think just because of its recency of coming to be a term that was in wide usage, yeah, misogyny just didn't have a lot of explicit theorizing that defined it. So I kind of tried to come up with a theory that was like the one I was looking for when I first wanted to write about the Isla Vista killings. I looked for a definition and couldn't find one that fit the usage pattern of feminists.
Now, you use a lot of examples in your book, like the Elliot Rodgers and the Isla Vista killings, and to the first Donald Trump's first divorce from Ivana. You use a lot of real, you know, you use Rush Limbaugh, and you use a lot of real examples. But how does misogyny work or show up in everyday interactions, things that are not quite as extreme or as public?
Yeah. So I think, and this is something that comes out at the end of the book, I think it often takes the form of being slightly taken aback or just showing slight, often subtle disgust reactions to non-conforming women, which then get rationalized because, you know, when you have an inchoate sort of reaction to someone doing something, it's often tempting to think, well, there must be something a bit off about them. Like maybe they're somehow, you know, their behavior is kind of inappropriate somehow, or they're not fully responsible and they're, you know, showing a lack of care somehow, or whatever it is. And that's where I think we get these superficially gender-neutral criticisms of women that involve being, yeah, a little taken aback, a little hostile, that don't have the sort of brazen and shameless quality of the misogyny evinced by Donald Trump, say. They have much more plausible deniability. But it's why, say, you know, like a female job candidate in philosophy might have to navigate between seeming like, you know, a bad philosopher and not being incisive enough versus a bad woman, hence person, in being too abrasive.
Yes. So, and men are never judged to be aggressive or abrasive. They're just assertive. They're ambitious, which is a good thing.
Well, I think they sometimes are. And I mean, I think it differs too for men of color. I think there are different, you know, ways in which both race and class probably intersect with this quite, you know, in quite subtle ways. But I do think that the comparison I like to draw is between men and women in the same, with the same intersecting social factors, such that I think if you compare, say, you know, a white man and a white woman, he will certainly be held to much lower standards in terms of interpersonal civility before he's judged abrasive, all else being equal. So that's like a very hedged way of putting it, but
no, I understand. So do some men benefit more than others? This is kind of relative, right? It depends on the man's position of power, relative position of power in society.
I think it definitely, you know, that's a particularly good question because I think it benefits white men, you know, just vastly more in general. So I think misogyny has to be seen as a system of law enforcement that works within, in this context, a white supremacist heteropatriarchy. So it enforces the sort of heteropatriarchal elements of what's also a white supremacist system. And because of that, I think what you often find is, and this is important, I think, in understanding white women's complicity in certain forms of misogyny, you find these powerful white men who, especially if they're wealthy and, you know, and non-disabled and, you know, I should make explicit cis and het before getting into the rest of the, you know, example that, you know, you mentioned someone like Donald Trump in relation to his first wife, Ivana. Someone like that has pretty well, you know, in some cases, breathtaking amounts of legal, moral, and social impunity for crimes they commit. So when you get someone in that kind of position who's what I call hyper-privileged, they'll get enormous benefits both in the form of women who are deferential to them and who play a subordinate role, and in the context of intimate relationships, due to the kind of racist forces that see white men in that position disproportionately partnering with white women, you will see kind of a class of white women who play very deferential and subordinate social roles with respect to those powerful men, but pay a very hefty price if they err with respect to his will. So that's what I think my introduction is designed to show, to get at both the degree to which white men really benefit from this, and also the extent to which white women are incentivized within the context, like the one I've just defined, not to rock the boat, not to, you know, step out of line.
Now, is there, we're talking here about a certain kind of what you talk about, an expectation of an asymmetrical moral support roles for women, that there are expectations placed on women in terms of how much support they are supposed to offer certain men. But I was wondering if there is also a reverse expectation on men. Do we have an expectation of men that women do not have? Or do they get a free ride?
I mean, I certainly think there are some norms and expectations. You know, like the most obvious one traditionally is the breadwinner role. But in some ways, those asymmetrical expectations are breaking down. And in other ways, sometimes what you find is a sort of violent lashing out or punching down when he's unable to fulfill those kinds of roles. You don't tend to find women committing domestic violence because their man isn't a good provider, even if they subscribe to those sorts of defunct gender norms. What you find is the opposite, actually, that if he can't fulfill the sort of tenets of traditional masculinity, which compromises his pride in certain ways, you know, that tends to be, you know, a predictor for domestic violence of certain kinds committed by him rather than her.
So basically, are we saying also too that what is expected of women has not really changed, even though on the surface, you know, women are working more and outside the home, and they're having careers and they're advancing on the surface. But fundamentally, they can do that, but they still have to maintain a certain position, a deference, an attitude of deference.
Yeah, I think the interpersonal relations have changed in terms of what's permitted and expected, much less than one would hope and maybe expect on the surface. So, I should say that often when I talk about what's possible or permissible or tolerated. You know, I'm not making predictions about how, you know, most, let alone all, relationships of the relevant kind go or how it always plays out. I think often these claims are best read as if he's not constrained by moral conscience or principle or other social messages that, to be sure, can be there. You know, there are obviously, you know, men who have their feminist consciousness raised and, you know, don't subscribe to, you know, or have conflicting views, but who, you know, are pretty woke, to use like a term I'm kind of fond of here. But I think there's just a social permission there, which means that if those various constraints and forms of, you know, consciousness raising and education aren't there, then things can go very wrong in this direction. Particularly, again, when it's someone who's a man who's not subject to oppressive social forces because he's a man of color in a white supremacy. When he's a man who forces sort of, you can think of them, you know, roughly as wanting to keep him on top of the world, it's very hard to send him down.
Well, what it seems to me like is that the liberal feminist project has made quite a few advances, but the radical feminist project, which was always from the very beginning, really aimed at culture and the relationships, you know, the interpersonal relationship between men and women. That's the project that has not advanced as far as, you know, the liberal project. You know, that's my take on this. But anyway, let me ask you about how do women support women themselves or enable misogyny? Is there some sort of element of interdependence or enabling, or, you know, because this is not about blaming the victim, but understanding that women do have a certain responsibility.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. A kind of forward looking responsibility while understanding how hard it is to be fully resistant to these forces because, you know, they're so strong and the consequences of stepping out of line are so high. And the thing is, misogyny gives women options. So when, you know, I roll my eyes at the idea that, you know, of the old saw that feminism is all about choice, well, not really, because misogyny sorts women into good women and bad women, roughly speaking, whereas sexism tends to sort men from women, according to natural capacities. But to go back to misogyny sorting bad women and good women, there are huge incentives to present yourself and, in fact, make yourself into a good woman, a quote-unquote good woman, by the lights of patriarchal ideology. And that can be very sort of tempting and seductive and deceptive. It can mean being oriented to male writers or philosophers. It can mean putting up with mistreatment, both of yourself and also other women, by just always kind of looking on the bright side and siding with him over the women who testify against him, or even just, you know, show reservations about the way he's proceeded. So I think there are all sorts of temptations that it would be wrong, just as you say, to blame the victim, because really, you know, there is a lot of victimization here. But it also has to be recognized that, you know, particularly when it comes to white women, we have often victims of misogyny who are also effectively oppressing more vulnerable women, say women of color, in ways that really call for being corrected going forward.
You know, it's the old idea that, you know, women who gain particular positions of power, you know, the idea that they don't help other women, you know, whether that's true or not, but the idea that women who are in positions of power may be a little smug about their power and begin to say, well, these other women aren't where I am because you know, whatever. You could list.
They're bad in some, like, whatever way. They're just not that good, or they have only themselves to blame in some insert spurious explanation.
So basically they become, they're special.
Yeah. And I mean, there's sort of another aspect of it too, though, which is I do think women complain about women not supporting other women, you know, particularly when women are looking for mentorship or similar. But I also think often those complaints, you know, have some validity, but it's also true that men are not called upon to support women nearly enough. So when I talk about those asymmetrical obligations, I think a large part of what needs to be corrected isn't, you know, the idea that we approve of and sometimes have strong norms in favor of giving and being, you know, very respectful without being deferential, or being, you know, careful to not hurt others' feelings and offering concrete material as well as moral support. It's just that those norms should apply regardless of gender. And so you get so few calls for men to be not just good fathers, but if they're in het or so-called straight relationships, like what about being a supportive husband or partner? Like that just does, like I just can't find those articles, but they should be there.
Okay, so there's an issue that you talk about that women engage in, which was I thought was very interesting, the self-gaslighting. Can you talk a little bit about that? How does that work? Because you give some examples with Harvey Weinstein, and then also I think Ivana Trump and some other women.
So I think you might be referring to Steve Bannon.
Bannon, that's exactly right. Okay.
Yeah, right. Just because Weinstein wasn't yet on the radar,
exactly.
So that would have been truly prescient on my part. So I don't want to take credit if it's not due. But I think, you know, but I mean, for that matter, Weinstein's victims often show this same pattern. And I think Selma Hayek showed a really, her op-ed about this, which was published, you know, just last week. At the time we're having this conversation, I found that a really powerful testament to how that can happen, where you have a powerful man, he's been very abusive, and if a woman feels, you know, very disempowered in that role, which is, you know, it's kind of by hypothesis pretty normal to feel that way, given that the very moves he makes are expressive of, you know, domination and, you know, their power moves. And so feeling powerful with regard to him is going to not be the default. So I think what can happen is either after coming forward and telling your story or not, there are these cases where women just convince themselves that he's forgivable in the case of Hayek, that, you know, she convinced herself she'd forgiven him and then realized that wasn't the case, especially since, you know, he never apologized to her, at least in anything like a full way. So, you know, it's hard to see how there could be a forgiveness without some, you know, interpersonal reparation of a kind that expressed recognition. But yeah, you also get women who tell their stories in this very, you know, impressively strong way and talk about, in the case of Andy Puzder's ex-wife, Lisa, she talked about how the patriarchal forces were making this very difficult, but she had to stand strong and do this for herself. And then you find these women like totally eating their words years later and coming out and saying with, you know, certainly what looks like not just sincerity, but just conviction. He did nothing wrong. He was a good husband. He was not abusive.
And, you know, this happens all the time in domestic abuse cases where women will complain, you know, call the police, they're being hit, the police shows up, and the woman says, oh, it's okay. We got, you know, we patched it up. There's not a problem, but she's got a black eye. So So now they're, we're trying to move away from just listening, not just using the women's testimony, because she may waffle on that.
I think evidence-based cases, your so-called purely evidence-based cases for the crime of strangulation are being pushed by prosecutors because it's just so hard to get women to testify consistently about what happened. And I think, that's a very important point about not taking women's testimony seriously. When we say we should take her seriously, we're often implicitly assuming that we mean in context where she's saying something that goes against the patriarchal grain. And if so, then I agree. But women are so gaslit, like often they're going to deny that there was a problem, in which case I don't give, any more credence to her testimony than seems warranted by the overall evidence. So if she says he's a great guy, I think, well, okay, you have a black eye, I'll reserve judgment.
Well, there is a, there was a YouTube video showing clips from movies, from the earliest movies that we've had in the 20th century, where men spanked, strangled, did all kinds of stuff for on women's bodies as sort of just good humor, okay? Yes, it's very interesting set of clips. And and people laughed. People didn't think anything about it. It was like, oh, this is the way it is. Men, doing all kinds of things to women as sort of just a humorous thing. And that's how ingrained this is. If I find that, I'm going to get that to you. But the thing about it that with the Weinstein case, since we're now up to this present moment, what I've already seen, I don't know if you've already seen it, but I have the what you call empathy. Which is, we're beginning to see, oh, we've gone far enough with this. We need to cut it out. I even had I saw a journalist that basically say, a woman basically said, okay, we need to get to reconciliation. We need to reconcile. And I'm going, really? That quick?
Yeah, I had the same thing not 2 days ago. My jaw just dropped. It was like, that sort of hurry to, okay, well, we've heard all the stories. It's like, no, we're just beginning. And I think it just does such a disservice in the face of what does seem to me, a really important and sort of structurally anomalous kind of brilliant moment that's been ushered in under the Me Too hashtag. In large part because Tarana Burke's phrase has that kind of, it's brilliant because it gets at a narrative which centers on the self for a moment and then it passes the baton on and says, okay, me, but this is not unique. What about you? And hey, it turns out that as many of us have long appreciated if we've been working in this area, but have not had, the wherewithal to kind of show definitively, this is so prevalent that, many, if not most women, as well as some men and a lot of non-binary folks have a Me Too story or several or dozens. And so I think the whole question of, well, what about him, this empathy and excessive sympathy for the bright futures that might be spoiled by recognizing core moral truths, together with this, okay, how do we move forward from here? Like, nah, premature.
No, it also has to do with the fact that I think a lot of people think this is like something new that just happened, and we'll get over it. Instead of really, it's not just one event. This is historical. This has been going on for centuries and centuries. This is not like, oh, we're just having a moment here. And then, of course, people having explanations like, well, this is because of feminism. This is because of the sexual revolution. This is because, women have entered the workplace. Maybe if they'd stayed out of the workplace, we wouldn't have this problem.
That's an amazingly victim-blaming right. Really, that's the issue and not. If for that matter, if like men didn't live in women's houses, then there,
these ideas were used. White women should be out of, not be in the military, because if you put women in the military, you're subjecting them to being, you know, sexually abused or assaulted or whatever, because men are men. So let's keep women out instead of saying, "What? Wait a minute, why don't you ask the men to change?"
Yeah, it's really egregious. And it's, you know, it's, the thing is, in some ways, it's been such a good moment for my book to come out. But in another way, it's just been that all the other moments were bad. Like, I joked sort of sardonically in the conclusion of my book that I had a much easier time getting people interested in this, to me, very minor topic that I wrote on, namely trigger warnings in pedagogy. I think, you know, I wrote like a New York Times piece just saying why I use them in contexts where I teach, you know, say sexual assault, which I teach, you know, quite regularly. I teach, you know, stuff that, you know, for students who've been raped sometimes recently, to my knowledge, I just feel like, you know, an irresponsible person and unkind just sort of throwing that material in their faces rather than saying, hey, heads up, this will be on the menu for discussion so they can prepare themselves. And often are very grateful that we are talking about it, because avoidance isn't the purpose. It's, you know, preparation. Anyway, that was all I had to say about it. But I got so much more interest in that than misogyny up until, like the book came out at the right time. But it's worth emphasizing, people have been so oblivious to this phenomenon and so reluctant to see what's always been happening, that I think we need to emphasize that this is coming out. It's not that it's just this, you know, trend thing. It's just telling truths that there's been, you know, a long and weighty silence around.
It also seems that masculinity, in a way, is fragile. And, you know, men have been in a state of crisis forever. There's always a male crisis of some sort, okay, whether, you know, whatever, women are working, women are, you know, they're going off to war, and there's the feminist movement. There's always some, after the Civil War, every decade has a new male crisis. So are men that fragile? Is there sort of a master-slave dialectic going on here where men need women to be subservient or somehow beneath them in order for them to feel masculine?
Yeah, there is something very master-slave about a particular dynamic that I've been thinking about quite a bit recently, where I think there's a certain kind of fragile masculinity that is very Trump-like, actually, that constantly wants to win, but with the emphasis both on winning and constantly. So basically, he wants guarantees that he can't have. So he wants to win. So that means there has to be a real possibility of losing for it to be a genuine game or a genuine argument, say, with a woman, or a genuine tussle for, like, her consent, you know, the chase, as they say in dating, perniciously. But on the other hand, he wants guarantees that he won't lose the argument or have to face rejection or, you know, be humiliated in some way that involves her saying no to him or clashing with his will. So he both, like, will set things up, I think, often via gaslighting, so she won't say no and she won't disagree and she won't withhold consent. But he still has this precarious, necessarily precarious because it's fake, sense of being a winner or, you know, or conquering her.
Like, you conquer land, you conquer women. This sort of kind of goes together, doesn't it, in the history of war. Now, let me ask you, how much of breaking the power of misogyny depends on women becoming really conscious of it? I think a lot of women are not aware, because it's so naturalized. It's so much in the water that we don't even see it a lot of time. And how do we confront it? How do we, what does a refusal of misogyny look like?
Yeah, I think a lot of it will depend on women to just resist the false obligations placed on us and with it shrug off some of the guilt or shame or, you know, related forms of moralizing that accompany just refusing to toe the patriarchal line. Part of it too, I think, will be reorienting not to sources of white male authority, but listening to other women and, you know, for white women like me, reorienting to women of color in particular in terms of creative voices who, you know, just by in virtue of the kinds of social forces we're subject to, both, you know, culturally and in education, we just will have missed a lot of the best, you know, stuff and the most interesting material that, you know, creatively and politically will help us muster resistance. So I think my book is much less about sort of, you know, telling men not to do this or that, because in as much as, you know, a man is really committed to certain kinds of misogynistic behavior, either he's not going to want to hear it from me, or he'll hear it from me but then never apply it to his own actions. You know, and that's true, unfortunately, of many sort of woke-sounding misogynists who can say all the right things, but they never, you know, they're never able to, you know, face shame and see what they do as domineering.
You know, the other side of this is that I've known many women, professional women, who have attained incredible amounts of success professionally, financially, you know, in every kind of independence you can imagine. However, when it comes to their interpersonal, intimate relationships with men, they fall into this thing where they don't speak up and they become, you know, victims of certain kinds of misogyny that they don't recognize because they think it's just the way men and women relate to each other in interpersonal relationships. But if you look at the woman from the outside, she looks great. She's very successful. But there, then this is why I said that the work of liberal feminism has been great, but the work of cultural feminism or radical feminism has not been completed. We haven't even touched it. And I'm kind of wondering about girls here too. How do we train girls from a very young age to be, you know, pleasing?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting distinction. I mean, I've never identified as a liberal feminist, but that's really nicely brought out my sort of problem with liberal feminism and, you know, my sympathy with, you know, certain kinds of voices. You know, like Andrea Dworkin for me is a huge inspiration. I mean, you know, there are fair criticisms of her work, like it not being intersectional enough, which is really important, but you know, the stuff that is, you know, still either applicable or adaptable with modifications, you know, to sort of update it in those ways, like really, really resonates. And I think there's been a lot of fear on the part of women that it won't be pleasing to draw attention to some of the dynamics she brings out so well. It's like, yeah, no, it won't be. That's the point in a way. Unless you really, like, I mean, maybe the other thing is that I think holding men to higher moral standards and higher feminist standards has to be part of it. You know, it can't just be on, but there I think it has to start, you know, pretty young.
Now, the thing that happens here, of course, in the latest incarnation of this thing is that it seems like women only of a certain class who have the power and some money and some connections, they have a social safety net, whether it's other women, to come forward and make these claims against many men. And I'm wondering, so you've got professional and artistic class women being able to do this, but how do we get down to where most women live, which is if you're working in a fast food restaurant or you're working a regular job somewhere, you may be subject to daily sexual harassment or demeaning misogynistic attitudes, but you really don't have the safety net. You don't have the social safety net. You don't have an economic safety net. you basically in a situation where you cannot complain because you're going to lose your job.
Yeah, no, and that's the crucial thing. Like, it's I don't have the solutions because it's, you know, but it just seems to me a sort of crucial policy question going forward, and, you know, question, you know, as activists that we have to think carefully and urgently about, because it's no accident that Harvey Weinstein was the first to be really exposed as someone whose victims were, for the most part, white, Hollywood beautiful, independently wealthy, independent reputations, often beloved in certain ways as famous actresses. This isn't to say to in any way underestimate or undermine the courage and the importance of what they did, but it's to say that those that testimony was something that they could afford and so many other women can't. And yeah, I mean, one thing that I've...
And I know one of the things with your... No, one of the things with your book was, and I know you've heard it, that because I've read some of the criticisms that you don't offer any real solutions to this. Well, you know, I'm on your side. It's very, you know, your job is to analyze the problem and bring it out into the light. You can't provide policy solutions and how we're going to change society because it's going to take everybody.
Totally. I mean, I sort of found it funny in a way that people missed. I had there was a review in The Guardian that yesterday that I thought was particularly just obtuse in missing the point of my conclusion, which was, you know, I say at a certain moment, I give up. And the title of the conclusion is The Giving She. And the point of it was, you know, at that point, having written 350-odd pages, really trying to be careful and precise, you know, and add what I could to an understanding of the problem, I didn't have anything left by way of solutions. That's not to say that there aren't any, you know, especially piecemeal and ones that have to be brainstormed on the ground by people with lots of different experiences. So the combination of, you know, I didn't have anything left to give because I was a used up giving tree. And I think solutions come from sort of grassroots collective brainstorming amongst women from very different social positions, necessarily. Whereas I think, you know, I would never claim to illuminate all aspects of the problem of misogyny, but I think, you know, I could put my finger on some and then, you know, make explicit note of the fact that there was stuff I couldn't speak to and leave space for other theorists. Say, you know, when it came to trans misogyny, I didn't feel qualified to speak to that, but I could say, here is something crucial we need theorists to you know, to add to an existing literature that's, you know, incredibly rich, but still in analytic philosophy, you know, fairly small, with, you know, notable exceptions like Talia May Betcher and Rachel McKinnon, who are, you know, both doing amazing work, but we need more trans voices. Anyway, point being, I just find this demand for solutions, it's yet another demand imposed after, like, and I do sort of feel like, well, criticize the book by all means within its framework, but don't ask me to give yet more. If you're doing that, you've just missed the point of my critique.
Right. Well, your point was to redefine a word and to apply it and to name things with that new written definition, because once you name it, it becomes visible. And between your naming and what we're having right now with the Me Too campaign, it's definitely making things much more visible, harder to ignore, and hopefully it will change even a little bit the way men and women interact in the workplace.
Yeah, exactly. I think I have a lot of faith in people when they're empowered and when the structures are such that they, you know, give people enough space, both materially and socially, to protest against certain kinds of abuses, then I think, you know, offering concepts that can help crystallize those abuses or problems. I know at least in my case, having certain concepts has really helped me just be, you know, a more politically active and sometimes self-assertive person. But yeah, it's the solution in a way is partly offer tools, you know, in the long feminist tradition of offering tools that help crystallize social problems that otherwise remain either nameless or kind of verboten to name. And then, hope people do something with those tools, with a bit of optimism actually about the human spirit to sort of fight. If you feel like you are entitled to fight, then I think often people will.
Kate, thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous. And thank you. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. This has been a special edition in collaboration with the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. This is your host, Lillian Barger.